Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Harris County versus Dillard.
May it please the court, Mr. Frank Sanders will present argument for the petitioner. Mr. Sanders has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm Frank Sanders for Harris County in this case. This court has held that giving an improper instruction to a jury and one that misstates the law is harmful error. That's exactly what happened in this case. I think this case is very similar to two Supreme Court cases I've cited in my brief, Mitchell versus Missouri, Kansas, and Texas Railroad, and another railroad case involving the FVLA. In both of those cases, the harmful issue in question misstated the law, the burden of proof that was required under the FVLA. They were railroad injury cases. In one of the cases, the jury was given an instruction that included foreseeability, which is not required under the FVLA, and the court reversed that case, holding that this imposed an improper burden of proof. Proximate cause also is not an element under the FVLA. It's not proper to give such an instruction. In a case where it was given, judgment was reversed, and case was remanded. In the case of Barr, the improper instruction quoted a statute that was not applicable to this particular lawsuit, which was a case against Harris County under the Texas Tort Claims Act. Under the Tort Claims Act, in order for liability to be imposed on a governmental unit, the person accused of the wrongful act of the negligence must be an employee. And under the Tort Claims Act, section 101.001, the very first thing in the act, employee is specifically defined as a person in the paid employment of the governmental unit by competent authority. In this case, it's absolutely undisputed. In fact, the plaintiffs have conceded on the third page of their response to the application for writ of error in this case that the man involved in the accident through which they tried to impose liability on the county was never in the paid employment of Harris County.
If this deputy, though, had been called by the sheriff's office and said, we need you to work today, we want you to go to a certain place and work in that area, would that have changed the situation?
No, Your Honor, would not, because he still would not be a paid employee, which is absolutely required under section...
But he would have been under their direct supervision. They direct him to go to a certain place and perform law enforcement duties the same as any paid employee.
He would be, Your Honor, but he still would not be a paid employee, which is required under the plain terms of the Tort Claims Act. And this court has ruled many times that the state, the government, is entitled to sovereign immunity, and when it waives sovereign immunity, it can put whatever conditions and limitations on that waiver that it wishes to do so. In this case, the legislature has chosen to put this requirement on liability against a governmental unit that liability must be incurred by a paid employee. But to take care of that situation, the legislature has passed Chapter 102 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, which caused the confusion and caused the problem in this case. In the situation you just gave me, that this person that was specifically called out by the sheriff and put on duty got in an accident and hurt somebody, he was sued and judgment rendered against him, Chapter 102 would allow the governmental unit to pay those damages, even though the Tort Claims Act requires paid employment in order to impose mandatory liability on the governmental unit. Chapter 102 is kind of an escape hatch. Since the Tort Claims...
But Chapter 102 doesn't apply to strict volunteers.
Chapter 102, at this point in time, does apply to volunteers.
So that would not be the situation where they were called and directed, but just someone volunteers to do so, and so then the action should be brought under Chapter 102 rather than under the Tort Claim.
Chapter 102, in my opinion, is not the kind of statute that creates a cause of action. It has no effect on immunity. It doesn't waive it. It doesn't create any liability. What it does, if for whatever reason a plaintiff sues an employee, a volunteer, somebody who has some connection with the governmental unit, and they either can't or don't sue the governmental unit, and they get a judgment against this person, Chapter 102 is a statutory authorization for the governmental unit to pay those damages if it decides it should do so.
They don't have to, it's just kind of an act of charity on their part.
They don't have to, it's an authorization, and I think the reason for that is because the Texas Constitution at numerous places...
They can volunteer, just like this person volunteered to pay it.
Under 102, they have the ability to pay the judgment. Constitution prohibits all governmental units from lending their credit or making gifts of public funds in any situation where they're not legally obligated to pay. Chapter 102, I think, is a way to get around these constitutional prohibitions against paying out public money when you're not legally obligated to do so. It gives the governmental unit discretion to make those payments.
So if you have two people that are standing right next to each other and they engage in the same grossly negligent conduct, if one of them is on the payroll, the governmental unit has to pay, and if the other one who's been called in and is under specific control along the lines that Judge Hightower indicated is not on the payroll, it's just a question of the benevolence of the governmental unit as to whether the judgment's ever satisfied.
That's correct, Your Honor, because that's what the legislature has seen fit to do. That's some of the limitations they have put on this limited waiver of sovereign immunity they have affected by the Texas Tort Claims Act. However, your question deals with grossly negligent conduct, and you could get into the question of intentional torts, and that's another limitation the legislature has placed on the waiver of sovereign immunity. A governmental unit can't be held liable for intentional torts of its employees. So the legislature has put many limitations and exceptions on the waiver of sovereign immunity that it affected, and that has been upheld.
Distinguish this from Smith against the University of Texas, where the court said that claim under the Tort Claims Act can arise through the negligence of an agent duly appointed to carry out the duties of a paid state employee?
Yes, I can, Your Honor. I think the biggest difference is that the Smith case was the appeal of a granting of a motion for summary judgment. The court found numerous grounds on which to reverse the summary judgment. Basically, in the Smith case, the plaintiff was injured at a track meet on University of Texas property by university property, by people that were under the direct supervision of a man who was appointed by the paid head track coach. That was all pointed out. And the reason the case was reversed was they found there was a use of university property involved in the claim that precluded summary judgment. They did go on and talk about volunteer. I believe that that opinion is incorrect. When you look at what the Tort Claims Act says, the plain language of what it requires in order to impose liability, but only so as it talks to volunteer. There were numerous other grounds on which this summary judgment was reversed, and the primary ones being that there was a university property, tangible property involved in the accident that caused the injury. Also, in the case of Barr, the man who caused the accident was merely engaged in a fit of drunken driving at the time of the accident. He was driving his girlfriend home from the bar after a night of drinking. He had not volunteered. He had not done anything for Harris County for 3 to 4 months before this accident. He had in the past, 3 to 4 months earlier, worked as a reserve deputy. He had not done that within the 3 to 4 months prior to the evening in August when this accident happened. He admitted that. He admitted he was not even allowed to do patrol at the time the accident happened. He had been recovering from a foot injury, and over this 3 to 4 month period of time, he had been told if he wanted, he could go to the jail and work some assignments. He said he never did that. He never did anything. He admitted he couldn't do patrol. He admitted his car was not authorized to be used by him in carrying out deputy sheriff functions. You were not allowed to
to work as a deputy. If you were intoxicated, you were not allowed to work. If you had a passenger in your car, this was totally a concoction on his part when he got in this serious, tragic accident to try to save himself, I think, from criminal charges. It didn't work there, and unfortunately, in the trial court...
What type of criminal charges were brought against him?
Manslaughter. He had an alcoholic content of 0.15 after the accident, and he was charged with, I think, involuntary manslaughter and was convicted. I think he wanted to use this as, in his mind, it would be some kind of defense. It's also interesting, I think, that of all the people involved, he's the only one that ever saw or knew anything about this car that he claimed he was going to pursue.
Does the contention that you make, the position that you argue for, is, would that allow the state to get around the Tort Claims Act simply by having a state officer charged with any kind of a duty to appoint volunteers or unpaid agents to perform the duty, as long as they can get somebody to do it on a volunteer basis and they avoid actually doing it themselves? And, no matter how badly it's done, no matter how poorly they're supervised, no matter how gross the negligence, the state can still avoid liability simply by using volunteer agents to perform these duties?
Under the plain language of the Tort Claims Act, that would be the case. It requires people being in the paid performance of the...
Their duty to properly pick and properly train and properly supervise, this doesn't exist.
It exists under the civil rights laws. There are cases that...
You think that's what the legislature really intended?
The Radke case cited it by the plaintiffs makes it clear that there's no duty to supervise or to train an employee. The duty comes from the condition or use of a motor vehicle or tangible property.
This is particularly dangerous in the area of law enforcement, would you say?
I would, Your Honor, but it is, again, it's the plain language of the statute. It requires people to be in the paid service of the governmental unit, and Chapter 102 provides the escape hatch where a person can ask the Commissioner's Court, whatever the governing body of the governmental unit is, to pay any damages they may receive.
What is the likelihood that Harris County will go to an entirely volunteer force to avoid liability under the Tort Claims Act?
Absolutely zero. They could not find enough people to do it.
You don't think there's enough folks out there that would love to wear a badge and carry a gun that would step forward? Most communities don't have any trouble finding volunteer auxiliaries to augment their regular forces.
Harris County requires too many police officers. It's too dangerous. I cannot foresee that happening under any circumstances.
How many reserve deputies are there?
Your Honor, at this time, I do not know. I do not know.
There's more than just this one.
I'm sure that there are
several hundred.
No, not doubt, several hundred very much there.
I
would imagine it's less than 100.
You're arguing there is no responding on the part of public entities or their agents, no matter how poorly they're picked or how dangerous the positions that they're placed in.
Not under the Texas Tort Claims Act.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Ms. Mary Miller will argue for respondents. I have to disagree with counsel on what is the purpose of the Texas Tort Claims Act. The Texas Tort Claims Act is fairly clear when it says what is the waiver of governmental immunity, and that is that it will impose liability from the negligent use of an automobile by one of its employees, the same as if the county were a private person.
How is the word employee defined in the Act?
The word employee is defined in the Act to include, to say, a paid employee, then it includes specific exemptions. My argument being that the...
Do you find the word volunteer anywhere in that definition?
No, Your Honor, it does not. But my argument is that definition of employee is inconsistent with what is the stated purpose of the Act, and that a private person would be responsible for the liability or the actions of a volunteer. The definition of employee in the Texas Tort Claims Act is also inconsistent with Chapter 102, which defines an employee to include a volunteer. We brought suit both under Section 102 and Section 101 of the Texas Tort Claims Act. Our contention being that...
Is it your argument then that because it's inconsistent, it should include volunteers?
That is correct.
What principle is there that we must read the inconsistencies of the legislature consistent?
Because the way the court has to analyze is what is the purpose of the act. And the purpose of the act is to provide liability as though the governmental unit were a private person. That is the stated purpose of the act. If there is something in the act that is inconsistent or creates an ambiguity, then certainly that ambiguity, as this court has recently stated, should be resolved in favor of the claimant. And there are cases that have held as such. In particular,
can the legislature though circumscribe what it says its stated purpose is within the act itself by putting limitations within the act? What I'm saying is, can't the legislature say this is a purpose, and then in defining further in the act how that purpose is to be accomplished, put some limitations?
I think if that had been the legislature's intent in this case, what it would have said is the purpose of this statute is to impose liability the same as if a private person would, except in the situation of a volunteer.
If we accepted your position in this case, how does that then not vitiate the Tort Claims Act? Specifically, the Tort Claims Act that limits the amount of money for which the state would be liable. A private person is liable for all damages. If we state the principle that anything inconsistent in detail within the Act to the stated proposition of the Act, wouldn't we necessarily then say any limits on state liability that are not in relation to the damages suffered are also written out of the Act?
If I understand your question, it is, are you saying that any further limitations placed in the Texas Tort Claims Act, specifically so stated, such as the liability limitations, would then be contrary?
With the liability
no, I don't agree that that's true. And the reason why, number one, there is a specific restriction included in the statute that says we're going to restrict and we're going to exclude liability for anything over $100,000 per person, $300,000 per occurrence. That's a specific restriction. Employee specifically defines in that definition of employee those persons that it will not consider. And those persons that it specifically defines that it will not consider are one, an independent contractor, two, an employee of an independent contractor, and three, is my
anybody
memory.
Anybody that's not paid.
I'm sorry?
It also excludes anybody that's not paid.
It doesn't specifically exclude anyone that's not paid.
But it includes, you have to be paid to be included. Doesn't in requiring payment to be included exclude people that are not paid?
That's my argument that I'm trying to make. The original statute before it was amended also included language that said that this is intended to include anyone within the service of a governmental unit. When the statute was amended, it simply stated that that language was not included because it was meant to encompass all persons in the service of a governmental unit, not necessarily the paid service. But the situation you have in this particular situation is that this person was, in fact, doing the duties of the paid employee. And so Mr. Skeen, by acting as a deputy for Sheriff Klevenhagen, was, in essence, carrying out the duties of a paid employee. What we're not saying is that if there's a volunteer over who is not acting in the duty or in the place of a paid person, we're not contending that that element is not there. As I understand what you're saying is that if, say, for example, there was the county appointed a volunteer to head the parks board, and that volunteer was not subject to any duties of or any supervision by any other county employee, and that parks person basically got to do what they wanted, when they wanted, however they wanted to do it, and it was strictly a volunteer basis, and that person was not acting in the place of a paid person, that would be a completely different situation. But what you have here in this case is you have a deputy who is acting in the place of and at the direction of a paid employee, as in the Smith case.
But taking one step further, though, the fact of the matter is that governmental agencies feel they can provide additional services without additional taxes by the use of volunteers in strategic areas. The mere fact that a volunteer is used to further a state purpose, doesn't that almost by definition mean they've relieved the state of having to pay an employee to form that service?
But that's not what the government did in this case. The government in this case, the county appointed Sheriff Kleefenhagen to be the sheriff of that county. The sheriff then, according to statute, appointed deputy to fulfill his obligation to the county. And so that's a different situation than just by saying we're going to fulfill this government need with a volunteer. What they did in this particular situation, they filled the government need with a paid employee who then turned around and appointed deputies. But also addressing 102, why would the legislature have enacted 102? Why would the legislature have acted 102 if it was meant to be a useless act? Section 102, the county contends, is a discretionary act. I strongly disagree. 102 uses the word may, and it prescribes those situations in which a county government may pay damages by a volunteer, and that it has to be actual damages arising from the negligent conduct of that volunteer. Then it also prescribes situations where the county may not pay on behalf of a volunteer, such as when that action is grossly negligent or the officer is involved in an emergency situation. If we were not to consider 102 in considering what was the legislature's intent, I think we're missing the point. This court in...
But your deputy who was intoxicated, wouldn't that be gross negligence?
The jury did not find so in this case, Your Honor. A gross negligence question was submitted, and the jury rejected the county's contention of gross negligence. That was a finding made in this case. So no, in this particular case, that issue was presented by the county and rejected by the finder of fact. And that issue is not before this court. It was brought up at the appellate level, but it's not brought here. So in this particular case, this particular deputy was found to be negligent, but was also found not to be grossly negligent. So he falls within 102 without question.
You're saying that 102 is not a discretionary charitable thing that Justice Doggett described a while ago to opposing counsel, but that basically it is a hole that the legislature has put in the prohibition on public entities paying money to individuals. And if they get a judgment against them, this legislatively allows them to pay the judgment. They must pay the judgment because the prohibition no longer exists.
Exactly.
It's not a permissive thing. It's a hole in the prohibition.
Exactly.
And they can't use the prohibition as a defense.
Right. And I would point out to this court a case not cited in my brief, Webb versus New Laredo Hotel, and the Webb County Appraisal District versus New Laredo Hotel, which is a Texas Supreme Court decision from 1990. And in that case, it discusses when the word may is construed to be shall. And that rule is governed by the intention expressed in the statute. They also discuss in that opinion that the legislature would not perform a useless act, and I can't imagine any county gratuitously paying a judgment on behalf of a volunteer. That just does not make sense to me as a taxpayer. But secondly, that the act is clearly designed to allow those judgments to be paid. And if volunteer cannot be submitted to a jury, as was done in this case, in a negligence case, then how would we ever get to 102? How would we ever get to the obligation of the county to pay on behalf of a volunteer if it could not be submitted in this case? So when we submitted the definition under 102, we submitted what was a proper definition. But in considering the substantive issues of this case, I don't want to neglect what I believe to be strong arguments in our behalf, and that is that I don't think that the county preserved its point of error in this regard at the trial court or at the appellate court. In reading...
Excuse me. No, let me ask a question. Do we have a judgment against the deputy in this case?
Yes, we do.
And that's part of all of this that's up here?
That is correct.
And part of your argument to us is that there's some mandatory, with this judgment against the deputy, there is a mandatory obligation under 102 for the county to pay those damages.
If the circumstances arise as they arose in this case, that is number one, he is involved in the course and scope of his employment, which was so found, and number two, it involves an action for negligence, which this case was. The situation that it would be excluded is if, in fact, he had been found to be grossly negligent, which he was not found to be in this case.
are found not to be as a volunteer for the county at the time he was doing whatever it was.
But he was found not to be in course and scope of his employment at the time. But the jury in this case did find that he was in the course and scope of his employment and rejected the county's argument that he had been suspended and rejected the county's argument that he did not have the authority to act as he did. Getting back to my point, though, on waiver, I know that this court has discussed what is necessary to preserve charge at the trial court in some detail recently, and I have to confess, as primarily a trial lawyer, not appellate lawyer, I don't know what the standard is or what the standard will be, but the most recent pronouncement in the Keach case basically dittoed what we find in the rule of procedure, and that is that the objection must be specific and the grounds for the objection must be specific. I don't think Harris County came even close to meeting the requirement of preserving its complaints in the trial court. Never did it use the word objection. Never did it use the words, we object to the definition as stated. Simply what the county did was say, we've got a better definition and we want to submit it instead. The cases that have come before us have clearly held that that is not sufficient to distinctly point out the objection and to raise the grounds therefore. I would also point out to the court another opinion that was not cited in my brief that I came across, and that is the Motor 9 Inc. versus World Tire Corporation case. It's found at 651 Southwest 2nd 296. It's out of the Amarillo Court of Appeals, 1983, and it's a writ refused NRE case. In that case, the court held that the objection that the definition was not the correct legal definition is not specific enough to preserve error. And in that case, the appellant certainly made much more effort at it that was made in this case to preserve error. Mrs. Robinson, who argued this case before the trial court, never objected in any specific way to the definition as prescribed, but instead offered the court a different definition. I would also point out that I believe that Harris County raised failed to brief this point of error at the court below. Their point of error was number two, and nowhere under point of error number two, or for that matter the entire brief, did they ever discuss the charge, error in the charge, error in an instruction in the charge. It was simply not raised. And in fact, the error that was raised did not even bring forth the proper standard of review, which I've heard for the first time brought by the county today, and that it was that the law was wrong. The law given to the jury was wrong. Rather, they stated that it was, or led the jury to an improper conclusion. So
did
for
the
that,
alternative definition of employee tendered by the county include or delete reference to volunteers and merely just include paid employees?
It did not specifically say a volunteer should not be considered. What it said is just strictly that an employee is a paid person. It did not exclude volunteers.
Correct. Chapter 101.
Exactly.
If not at this point, what did, I have not looked at these Court of Appeals briefs, what did Harris County brief in the Court of Appeals?
They basically had two points of error. One was after the trial court erred in granting its summary judgment based upon the doctrine of sovereign immunity. And then its second point was that the definition given was contrary to, or it impermissibly led the jury to the wrong conclusion. And they briefed under that points one and error, one and two under the same grouping, but they never addressed at all any error in the charge, period. It just was never brought up.
Well, if it was error not to grant this motion on summary judgment.
That was addressed.
Facts might.
That was addressed in the court below, but they did not address error in the charge. The first Court of Appeals opinion that was issued in...
The Court of Appeals says, in point of error number two, Harris County complains the trial court erred in overruling its objection to the definition of employee in question three. That's just wrong.
The point of error states that. No question about it, but it's never briefed or argued. And that's my contention. The Court of Appeals, when issued its initial opinion in this case, found that the county did not preserve error at the trial court level by properly objecting to the charge. It backed off of that opinion on motion for a rehearing, but did not state in its opinion one way or another where was distinctly the objection and where was the grounds for the objection. Where did they find it at the trial court? They just said, well, they objected, and we find it, and that's enough, and never pointed it out in the record at all where they found that.
Did you point this out in the motion for rehearing?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did, in our response, absolutely.
What did they do with the your motion?
Oh, I'm sorry. On their motion for rehearing?
No, did you point out the fact that the Court of Appeals had found in their second opinion the fact that the county had preserved this point?
There was not a second motion for rehearing. There was only one motion for rehearing.
So you did not file a motion for rehearing on that?
No, I did not. No, I did not, because it was still the opinion was still in our favor.
In your favor, so you prevailed.
That's correct. There was no need to. It would have been an exercise in asking for a more correct opinion.
There seemed to have been 7 points in the court.
I'm sorry?
There seemed to have been 7 points there.
That is probably correct. They also contended that the gross negligence finding was against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence and had some issues pertaining to the gross negligence instruction.
I thought you said there were two.
No, sir. I'm sorry. What I said was that there were 2 points of error that were grouped together for the purposes of argument, points 1 and 2. And in points 1 and 2, they addressed, point 1 was that the trial court erred in not granting the summary judgment. Point 2 was that the trial court erred in the definition of employee, but they never briefed that point underneath. The only point that they briefed was the denial of the motion for summary judgment. It was just simply not addressed. So from the procedural standpoint, before we even reach the substantive issues, I think this court has to strongly consider whether or not the points were preserved at the trial court or the Court of Appeals below. Our second point is that we believe that the Texas Tort Claims Act, the purpose of it clearly is to impose liability, as the Smith Court so stated, as if the county were a private person, and to allow the county to avoid liability by simply appointing unpaid volunteers who have the same rights, same duties, same obligations, controlled by the same rules, would frustrate the purpose of the Texas Tort Claims Act.
Does it make any difference that this gentleman was self-appointed, wasn't he?
No, he was not self-appointed.
I mean, he drank a couple of pitchers of beer and got the idea that he ought to put himself on duty, and he wasn't like the sheriff.
I'm glad you asked that question, as they always said.
Okay.
He was not self-appointed. And the reason why I say
sure
that...
So you have a good response then.
Because the directive of the Sheriff's Department allowed, provided, and encouraged a reserve deputy to place himself in the line of duty if the circumstances so warranted. And certainly Sheriff Kliefenhagen did not call him up every morning when he was going to work on his regularly assigned duties. And as stated by Mr. Skeen, by Deputy Womack, and by Lieutenant Orlando, they had all placed themselves in the line of duty pursuant to the sheriff's directive when the circumstances so warranted.
So basically a general invitation to do so when they thought it was appropriate.
That's correct. They had an obligation under their, as a reserve deputy, when the circumstances so warranted, to place themselves in the line of duty under the sheriff's directive.
The county's whole scheme then in using these volunteer people is that they're self-starters. They can start themselves.
I guess so. One of the points that was brought out in questioning of Mr. Sanders was how many are there. One of the points that one of the matters that is in this record, and that is Deputy Womack testified that there was not enough paid deputies, and that's the reason why they had these deputies use their own cars. There weren't enough cars. There weren't enough deputies for the county to be able to carry out its duties. And so these reserve deputies were an essential force.
Ms. Miller, with regards to getting back to the point of whether or not there was preservation of error.
Yes, sir.
The Court of Appeals says, in this instance, Harris County explained that its primary objection to the proposed definition was the inclusion of the term volunteer in the definition of employee. This explanation afforded the trial court an opportunity to correct any error by the inclusion of volunteer in the definition and preserve any such error for appeal. You obviously disagree with that.
I did. I disagree with the court's the court has added language to what Harris County said that had Harris County said what the Court of Appeals
said. Well, apparently they agreed with you initially.
They did.
In the first opinion, they went back and took another look at it and disagreed with it.
Right, and I wish they would have stated in their opinion on motion for rehearing where they found that language. It's not there. Mrs. Robinson, who was arguing for the court, Mr. Loeb had a few comments, but he was not recognized by the court, and the court requested one lawyer at a time. Never did Mrs. Robinson state that she objected to the charge. She just simply requested that a separate, different definition be replaced instead.
Well, whatever she said, the Court of Appeals was convinced that it was sufficient for the trial court to know that their objection was that the inclusion of the word volunteer.
That's what they found in their motion for rehearing, but the point also being they did not address the question of whether or not it was waived by failing to brief it at the Court of Appeals. That was not addressed by the Court of Appeals in their opinion.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Sanders, do you agree with Ms. Miller that one of the issues that's before us is whether or not Harris County under Section 102 has a mandatory obligation to pay the judgment against the deserved debtor?
I don't believe that's before us. It's never been brought up that that is a mandatory statute. The plain language of the statute says they may pay if, and then they list certain circumstances. The statute specifically says that 102.006, it has no effect on the Texas Tort Claims Act. It doesn't affect any defense or immunity under the Act. If there's a conflict, then it is resolved by Section 102.006.
Have you done any legislative history research on Section 102?
Only to the extent that at the time this accident happened, the word volunteer was not even included in Chapter 102. It was amended effective September of 1987 to include the word volunteer. When the accident happened in August of 86, the word volunteer was nowhere in the statute. The law is clear that you use the law in effect at the time something happens. Retroactive statutes are unconstitutional and go against the Code Construction Act. The idea that these reserve deputies are self-starters is absolutely untrue and false. The directive that she talks about here and made such a big issue of in the trial court says that reserve personnel, while not on active schedule duty with the department, have only the authority vested by law of a citizen and shall not normally go to the scene of any incident, emergency, or investigation. The law that controls reserve deputies, Chapter 85 of the Local Government Code, says when they're not assigned to duty at the call of the sheriff, they do not have any peace officer powers.
Well, what was she talking about when she said that the regulations specifically encourage them to place themselves on duty?
She's talking about Exhibit A, which was filed as a supplemental exhibit to her brief, to her response to my application for writ of error. And it was one of, I think, exhibit number one in the trial court. It's policy directive R-85-10. It absolutely does not say anyone can put themselves on duty. There is no such thing.
What does it say?
It says reserve personnel, while not on active scheduled duty with the department, have only the authority vested by law of a citizen and shall not normally go to the scene of any incident, emergency, or investigation without being properly dispatched. If circumstances seem to warrant doing so, the deputy will notify Communications Central of their intentions via radio or public service. In other words, if something happens, if there's an emergency, if they come upon the scene of an accident, if they come upon a crime in progress, possibly they can render aid like any citizen can do.
Notify Central of their intentions. What intentions?
Of whatever they've done or are going to do.
Did the deputy do that here?
No, he did not do that. These people...
He didn't get around to it. He says the accident occurred where he was reaching for the radio and trying to get to the Central.
That's what he claims. I wouldn't believe anything this person says.
Jury option did.
The fact is he did not do it. He had not done anything as a reserve deputy for over 3 months. He was totally unauthorized to act in this situation. The law makes it clear, unless you're called to duty by the sheriff, you only have the same powers and responsibilities as an ordinary citizen.
What in the world could she be talking about?
About this the self-starting, the authorization? It's this R-85-10, Exhibit A to her brief.
You read it specifically.
If you read it,
180 degrees in the other direction.
I agree, Your Honor. I agree totally.
Except if circumstances. I guess that's what she's talking about.
It doesn't say they can initiate anything. It says they can possibly go to the scene of an emergency or help out. It doesn't say that they can put themselves on duty. It doesn't say that they can take it upon themselves to do what this man was doing.
Well, if they can't do any of these things, I'm seems to be some ambiguous language in there. You have only this authority and you can't do anything except if circumstances required, you can call Central and tell us what you're going to do.
That's what it says, Your Honor.
It's seems to be some kind of a hole in there, there that directly conflicts with what you suggest, what the, and the preceding language suggests, unless there's an exception to the preceding language.
I think it's clear when they talk about an incident or emergency that if something's happened, if they're needed to assist, that's what this deals with. It does not say or even imply, I don't think, that they can put themselves on duty to initiate some kind of action.
But if they see an incident, if they see circumstances that require immediate law enforcement attention, that I assume would be the exception of any kind.
No, no, Your Honor. It says that they have only the duties or the powers of a citizen. And under the penal the Code of Criminal Procedure and the Penal Code, citizens have certain rights. They can do things in certain situations. This makes it clear that's all they have. The law...
But there's no need to call Central to tell them that you're going to act like a citizen.
I just think that it wants them to, if they get involved in something, they want the reserve deputy to let them know about it later on so they'll have a record of it. I think it's that simple. It does not mean they're self-starters.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument in the third cause. The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will please adjourn the court.
The audience will please rise.